Hey everyone, it's Marvin. This episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by Home Interrupted, a new podcast from our partners at Feet in Two Worlds. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to
Whoa!
Potluck.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast between books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Mervyn Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are here to discuss our July book club pick, A Tale for the Time Being by Ruth Ozeki. Apologies for coming at you a little bit later this month. It's been a busy month.
It's been Asian August.
Asian August. Lots of stuff going on. I myself have been I'm going to be watching Crazy Rich Asians for like the fourth time.
Yeah.
Still good, though. It's still good. They had a really great... So we're recording this on Wednesday, August the 8th, which is Chinese Father's Day.
Oh, FYI. I didn't know that. You guys had like a separate Father's
Day. Well, because 8 is Ba in Chinese.
Oh,
and
okay.
And Ba is
called
Dad. So it's an unofficial holiday that's only really celebrated in Chinese, like Mandarin-speaking countries.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, happy birthday to... Oh no,
happy birthday.
Happy Father's Day to all the dads out there. Happy Chinese Father's Day, that is.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, yes, last night was the Crazy Rich Asians premiere. It looked great. Very glamorous.
Oh, really? I have not seen any pictures because I've just been on a media blackout, so I wouldn't know.
They had a jade carpet, and everyone was like dressed to the nines, and it's what you like. Everyone just looked so good, so fashion.
Is it like that wedding scene in Crazy Rich Asians?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. I can picture it.
So yeah, we're getting closer to. Oh, speaking of Crazy Rich Asians. That is going to be our book club pick for this month, August.
And we are planning to get some people together for To All the Boys I've Loved Before, because I really want to talk about it with a bunch of people who have read it, because I read the first book and then I immediately bought the second book the same day. I was like, I need it.
Yeah, that one's coming out on Friday. Probably it's either going to be tomorrow as of the day you hear this, or it's already out.
But
big week for Asians in media.
Yes.
We can also dive into the movie during our book club discussion at the end of the month, too.
I feel like it's unavoidable. Like, really.
So that'll be your commentary from Books and Boba. But we're not here today to talk about Crazy Rich Asians. We're here to talk about A Tale for the Time Being. Quick spoiler warning. We're going to be talking about the story at length, in depth. So if you have not read it, there will be spoilers. And also a trigger warning that I realize now we should have probably given you when we assigned this book last month.
I'm a little bit peeved by that, by the way. Like, literally everyone who like knows that I like to read a lot, they've been recommending this book. They're like A Tale for the Time Being, it's so essential to Asian American literature. And I do agree, but I do wish that some people told me about some of the trigger warnings in this book, because I would have been more mentally prepared.
Yeah, this book involves suicide and bullying. Two of Rira's biggest triggers. We're not going to go at length about those themes, but just to warn that they are there. So for those of you who haven't read the book yet or are listening to us before reading the book,
just be aware.
Yeah.
And as always, we're going to start with the jacket description.
Yeah.
On a remote island in the Pacific Northwest, a Hello Kitty lunchbox washes up on the beach. Tucked inside is the diary of a 16-year-old Japanese girl named Nao Yasutani. Ruth, a writer who finds the lunchbox, suspects that it is debris from Japan's 2011 tsunami. When she begins to read the diary, Ruth quickly finds herself drawn into the mystery of Nao's fate. Meanwhile, in Tokyo, Nao, uprooted from her home in the U.S., bullied at school, and watching her parents spiral deeper into disaster, has decided to end her life. But first, she wants to recount the story of her great-grandmother, a 104-year-old Zen Buddhist nun, in the pages of her secret diary.
Yeah. So, I guess right off the bat, what the book jacket description tells you, this is a dual narrative type of story. Mm-hmm. And it's balanced between, so it alternates between Nao's diary and Ruth's story. And so Nao is a, I guess, Japanese-American girl?
Yeah, she is a Japanese-American girl who moves to Japan.
Mm-hmm. And Ruth is a writer based loosely on Ruth, the author of the book.
Yeah, yeah. Like, it's one of those narratives where the author puts themselves into the narrative.
Yeah.
But it's, like, the reason why it's written in third person is, according to Ruth Ozeki, the author, she wanted to have, like, this distance. So, like, she is able to, like, differentiate, like this is Ruth the character, and Ruth, like, the author is a little bit separated from it.
I wonder if that was weird to write, writing, like, a first-person diary of a fake person and then a third-person non-diary of, like, yourself.
Yeah, like, Ruth Ozeki started writing this in the early 2000s. Like, I think she started in, like, 2006. And she wrote Nao secret diary chapters. And she wanted to have another character reading it, but she didn't know, like, who it was for. Mm-hmm. So she auditioned, like, maybe five or six characters. And she's like, I don't know, I guess this one. So she, like, went to her publisher and editor being like, here's my draft. And then the tsunami happened.
Mm-hmm.
And she thought that the tsunami happened, and then the Fukushima nuclear disaster happened.
Yeah.
So by that point, she said, okay, well, my book is not relevant anymore because Japan has completely changed since that event. So she decided to go back and rework her novel, and she was still stuck on who should be reading the diary. So her husband recommended her to write herself in, saying, like, okay, well, pretend that it's you reading the diary and it's your reactions. And she was like, okay, I'll do that. But you also have to be in the book. So Oliver in the book is actually a characterization of her real-life husband, Oliver.
Is he also named Oliver?
Yes.
Okay. Does she
very,
actually...
Very, very meta, by the way.
I mean, it's not the first time we've read a book where an author has written themselves into the book.
Mm-hmm.
But it's... It's
you're talking about how to live safely in a science fictional universe by Charles Yu.
Yeah, by Charles
right?
Yu, who also, which is another book that deals with like quantum mechanics and multiple like time travel and things.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's like a requirement to write yourself into a book. You have to like mess with the laws of physics.
I have yet to read a book that doesn't use quantum mechanics for meta narratives. But if anybody knows of one, please tell us in the Goodreads forums.
What did you think about the way the book was written, though? Because I know Nao's diary in particular is written in a style that you have mentioned that you're not a fan
of. Yeah, I'm not a fan of stream of consciousness, but... I don't know. I really liked Nao's narrative. I think I liked Nao's narrative more than Ruth's perspective. Mm. Because with Nao, I feel, I don't know, like, because she's a 16-year-old girl, I found her thoughts fascinating. Because it's so different from what, like a woman in her 20s, 30s would think.
Yeah.
And I feel like teenagers, like, it's so hard being a kid nowadays. And like,
well, you can tell that she is a kid because of the way she perceives things and how self-centered she is.
Yeah, she's a really self-centered character. Yeah. But also, like, she is someone who you know, she's a Japanese American living in Japan, and it's a country that she really has no familiarity with it, and you can relate to that. And it's like you're a kid, and you're like there's not that much control in your life, and the fact that like her parents didn't tell her why they were moving to Japan, like that must have been like that must have sucked so much. Like imagine thinking that it's like okay, like I can move to Japan, but it's not going to be that much different. Like I'm sure like I'll make friends and like I'll have a normal school life.
I mean that's what someone who doesn't understand
the difference cultural
between Asians and Asian Americans would think, right? Like we see a narrative of like fish out of water all the time, but it's always like through the lens of like the white person or the white person going to a foreign country and finding themselves.
Or an older person, you know? Like
whereas like here is a character who is going to a place where everyone looks like them, but they're not the same.
Yeah.
It's similar to like what we read in Pachinko too. Like
Definitely. And like with now, like you can tell that she's a 16-year-old girl because she keeps mentioning Sunnyvale, which is where she's from. And as someone who actually like me staying in Los Angeles, that's the longest I've stayed in one place in my entire life. Because I moved around almost like every 2-3 years. And even in college, I came out here after 3 years. Mm. So I was just like, yeah, like I can understand like moving from like moving to a different place and when you move, you have like rose tinted glasses of like the place that you used to live in. And
is that how you feel about New York?
Yeah, actually, like there are some days where I'm like, man, should I move back to New York? Like, I really miss it. But then I think about how terrible it is. I was like, well, what are the reasons why I shouldn't move back to New York? Okay, like the weather, the rodents. Oh, the trains suck now. So, and all of my friends are moving out here. So there's no reason for me to move back there. But
you don't want to pay like twice what you're paying right now for a smaller place?
No, definitely not. I would not be able to afford to live in not even Brooklyn or maybe perhaps Queens. But
like East Queens.
Like like my commute would be an hour and a half. It's better for me to live in Jersey by that point.
But
she has these rose tinted glasses of Sunnyvale, and
it's interesting because so Ruth is about 14-15 during the story or during her diary.
Oh, you mean now, because you just said Ruth.
Sorry. It's interesting because so now it was about 14-15 while she was writing the diary, right? Mm-hmm. Like just like a year shy of 16, I think, is what she mentioned. And during her diary, 9/11 happens. So I'm assuming that she's about my age because I was a sophomore in high school when 9/11 happened.
Mm-hmm.
Or was it a junior? I think I was a junior. So she probably went to high school the same time I did. And by that time, Sunnyvale was very, very Asian. I have a lot of friends from out there, like, you know, Homestead High School, Cupertino High School, like all that, like Lynbrook. They have this whole, like, they have 4 or 5 major high schools there that are all pretty much like 80% Asian.
Yeah, like so, that's funny because she mentions like when she was living in Sunnyvale, she was like the only Asian kid. She's like, oh, like people think that being Japanese is cool in Sunnyvale. And when you move back to Japan, you're like, it's like nothing special because everyone's Japanese.
I'm sure she was probably one of the few Japanese people because I think Sunnyvale at that time is mostly Indian and Chinese.
Most likely. What did you think about the title, like A Tale for the Time Being?
Yeah, they like cracked that
pretty
open
like in the first sentence.
Line of the of
wait
the
what's
book.
The first sentence I want to
like hi I'm now I'm a time being or something like that.
My name is Now and I'm a time being. Do you know what a time being is? Well, if you give me a moment, I will tell you. A time being is someone who lives in time, and that means you and me and every one of us who is or was or ever will be.
Which is some like highfalutin like teen bullshit when I first read it, but it also made the title make a little bit more sense, or at least it clarified what the title meant.
Yeah.
It's not a tale for the time being, it's a tale for the time being.
Well, I think it can go both ways, like a tale for the time being as in now.
Yeah.
Now, she makes fun of that. She has a joke there in the book. But like, a tale for the time being now, like you're present while you are reading this book. And then a tale for a time being,
yeah.
A tale for a human.
And I mean, the book does deal with quantum mechanics, like time and perception and multiple world theories, Schrodinger's cat, like multiple states of being.
Mm-hmm. Also a lot of Zen. There's a lot of like Zen Buddhist, not theories, but like practices.
Yeah, I think the Zen part is more like throughout the book, whereas the quantum mechanics don't really come into play till the end, where they're kind of explaining a lot of it. I kind of found that a little bit, it took me out of the story because I kind of feel like the a lot of the fourth act is Oliver explaining quantum mechanics to Ruth, and it kind of bogged down the, it kind of slowed things down for me too much. I wasn't a huge fan of it, even though it was interesting to think about.
I mean, for me, the best parts for me was like reading Nao's secret diary.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I found myself very impatient being like, what happens? And I guess that's like the point of the novel. Cause like Ruth is going through the same thing. She's like, what happened? And she's like looking up stuff on Google.
It kind of reminded me of watching Tara's House.
Yeah.
Where you have like the story going on and then you have people commenting on the story on the side.
Yeah.
And like, not only is she like anxious about what happens to the characters, her husband is like
also invested.
Yeah, also invested because she's reading the diary to him. Like, so there's like multiple like stages or what's the right word? There's multiple levels of like consuming the story.
Yeah, right? Like and it's like really funny how the entire island, cuz she lives on this island where there's like only like maybe 50 people.
Yeah, in Canada. Like, yeah, British
and then
Columbia.
everyone knows like where she got the diary, what she's doing.
Yeah.
And they're like constantly asking her about it. So it's like, oh, everybody's kind of invested in this story and they're kind of wanting to know like what happened to this girl.
Yeah.
And it's really funny because, like, Ruth gets so caught up in it. She thinks that it's, like, happening present time.
Yeah.
But it actually, like, she wrote the book, like, before the tsunami. So it's, like, Oliver mentions that. He's like, well, why are you in a rush to, like, find out whether she's okay or not? Because, you know, like, she would be Marvin's age by then.
It's, I mean, the whole, like, Schrodinger's cat experiment. There's many instances of that in the book, right? Like through Ruth's not knowing if Nao is alive or dead.
She's both alive and dead.
In like even within like their actual cat, who's I guess named Schrodinger, but they call him Pesto, or how's
I'm not sure, but they call him Pesto, and that's the name that I kept thinking about while I was reading it.
At one point, Pesto disappears, and they don't know if he's alive or dead because there are wolves. And what did you think about learning about, like, island life in the Pacific Northwest?
I thought that was, like...
You have all these, like, characters that are... You have, like, the scavenger. You have the...
The nosy postal lady.
Yeah.
You have, like, the French-speaking person who lives in a cabin. I thought... Like, it was an interesting parallel because she lives on an island where it's, like, not very populated and it's, like, very nosy neighbors, but, like, there's a community, there's, like, a closeness to it, whereas, like, Nao lives in Tokyo, Japan, which then Japan's also an island, and it's, like, a densely populated city, and Nao feels like she's completely alone in her struggles. So it's, like, two completely different, situations.
Forms of isolation. Yeah,
forms of isolation.
So Ruth also moves to the island because she... Was it because of her mother or because of her husband?
I think it was for both. Mm-hmm. Like, she wanted to consolidate, like, all the sick people into one place so she didn't have to, like, keep moving back and forth. She was actually from Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And when Oliver, her husband, got sick, she was like, okay, well, I have to take care of my mother too. So, and her mother's going through Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. So that is why they moved to that island.
Yeah.
And, you know, Oliver really likes planting trees and he's like really involved in how to protect the environment.
It was like something culture, but basically he was preparing the Pacific Northwest for global warming, saying that one day these will be palm trees.
Yeah. Right, or something like that. But yeah, like for Ruth, we are introduced to her as a novelist who is trying to write a memoir of her late mother's life. And she is struggling to write her mother's memoir. And, you know, like a failed memoir is pretty much a novel, because the thing is, like, the memoirs, you have to tell the truth, and mm-hmm. novels, you make shit up.
Yeah.
So, and she's also like, she also kind of has a writer's block in writing like actual fictional stories. And it's at this moment that she finds the Hello Kitty box.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, inspiration comes from the strangest places, doesn't it?
I did like that as she was reading Now's diary, she was also putting the lessons learned from that diary into practice. Like learning about how to...
Zazen,
which is, I guess, meditation.
Yeah, it's like a form of meditation.
Yeah. I love that, like, that passage where Now was describing how this was like her grandmother's superpower or superpower. I guess Now's grandmother is the other major character
Chico.
In the story. Chico. She is 104-year-old allegedly. I don't think you ever learn her real age, or is 104 her real age?
104 is what she says, but like no one knows because she's the oldest person in their family.
Yeah, and I guess she's a nun. I guess she's I'm assuming it's Shinto or Buddhist.
I'm pretty sure it's Buddhist because...
But they also talked about like spirits and all things, which is a Shinto belief, right? Maybe it's
Maybe it's like a weird hybrid.
Yeah.
Because it's
Asia's
Japan.
Asia's full of weird hybrids. Yeah. Like when my family goes to temple, like we're not super religious, but the religion, quote unquote, that we practice is kind of a mixture of ancestor worship and Buddhism. Because I don't think Buddhism, as it's like supposed to be practiced, mm-hmm. also quote unquote, deals with a lot of like praying, right? It's just a lot more like reflection and meditation and giving up all worldly things.
Yeah, like my family is super Christian, like most Korean families, but when we do funerals and stuff like that part was very familiar to me.
Yeah, me too, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, the funeral scene when, okay, spoilers. We warned you already.
Yeah.
When Chico finally passes away at the end, like the cremation and the picking of bones with a chopstick. That's all some stuff that we did.
Yeah. Yeah. Like we, for the most part, also like do cremation. Mm-hmm. And yeah, like a lot of the bowing with like the portrait and also like offering like food at the table. Like we do that too, like for... Was it like Korean Thanksgiving? I'm not sure, but we have it's either the Lunar New Year or Mid-Autumn Festival. But it's like a day where you clean the graves and you like bow and you have like food set at the altar for the ghosts to eat, which I find really funny, because if you're Christian, then it doesn't correlate.
They're not supposed to come.
But it's like so ingrained in the culture that like you just do it.
I think for Japanese, it's the Obon Festival, right?
Yeah.
And it's funny because like Chinese families do the same thing. Like we lay out stuff to like bring the your loved ones back. And my aunt was watching Coco and saying, "Hey, Mexicans are just like us."
Oh my god!
But
Mexicans are just like us. Oh wow.
There was a part of a. So, I guess I want to talk about, let's talk about Now's relationship with Chico, because that's a huge, like, that is what kind of heals her in a way, like, kind of.
It's really what grounds her, because, you know, she's a teenage girl and she's getting bullied at school and there are so many things out of control and, you know, her parents are unable to emotionally support her. So Chico is the only grown-up who can, like, provide her that support and structure.
Even though it's all in riddles. But you can... what I loved about her passages about her relationship with Jiko is you can feel the love and warmth. And, like, the need to, like... Like, you can tell Jiko has a plan to help her great-granddaughter along.
And also, it, like, it's really great that there's, like, this one scene where Jiko asks her if she's angry. Mm-hmm. And then now just goes off. She's like, of course I'm angry. And she, like, lists all the things that are happening in her life. And she's like, why are you asking me that? It's, like, so obvious that I'm angry. And Jiko's like... He's like, oh, I didn't ask for me. I asked for you.
Yeah.
And that was a really poignant scene because she, excuse me, because she can't really unload all of that stuff on her dad. She can't unload it to her mom, who is also kind of, in a weird emotional spot as well. So, like, I feel like Jiko gave her space. And, you know, that's interesting because, like, because Nao's apartment is, like, super tiny and there's, like, no privacy. But when she goes to her, goes to Jiko's temple, there's, like, all the space. It's in the countryside. And, like, it is a way for her to, like, unleash a lot of her
anger. Love that at first she was so, like, it's like your typical, like, summer vacation story. Where I was like, I hate this. I don't want, there's no internet.
There's no internet.
There's no air conditioning. They don't do anything.
They're making me work.
Yeah. And then you realize that, like, sometimes you just need to, like, just, because social media by then wouldn't have been as
advanced
as now. But at the same time, like, I remember how attached I was to AIM and trying to figure out where all my friends were. Like, back then, which is, like, she would have been around AIM.
Yeah.
AIM time.
I mean, she mentions blogs and how sad it is. She's like, oh, I decided to, like, write all my, like, Japanese adventures on my blog, and I would lie. But, you know, I just realized that no one would even read my lies because people just make blogs for themselves and no one reads.
I remember all the emo shit I wrote in my blog. Which no longer exists because I deleted it.
I used to have a Zynga and... I didn't really write my feelings in it. It was more of a way for me to connect with K-pop fans. Because back then, we were like an underground group. Right. It was so hard to be a K-pop fan back then.
Blogs used to be how you subtweeted someone.
Yeah.
Like, you would go on a blog and say, "Ugh, I'm so over blah, blah, blah." And everyone's like, is that about me?
Yeah, because back then, like because the internet was so small.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like... Once you wrote something on the internet, like, people, like, knew immediately who you were talking about.
Or you put something in your away message.
Yeah.
Or your, like, your AIM profile.
Oh, God. I feel so old talking about this. Because now kids have, like, Snapchat and Instagram and TikTok and...
It's so much worse now.
Yeah, it is so much worse. And, like, I can't imagine the pressure to be a young person...
Yeah.
In this day and age. Because I remember, like, I got Facebook in junior year of high school. I came in late.
And we were very upset about that because we were like, Facebook should be for college students only. Because when first got Facebook, it was in, like, maybe, like, 30 colleges.
Oh,
We were part of an elite group of, the elite, like, non-MySpace users.
It was pretty much Tinder for, like, really nice colleges at that point.
Was it like Tinder? It was more
because like it first started with, it was kind of like a dating app. Like, oh, is this person in a relationship or not? Or like, is this person attractive or not? And then it evolved into like having
The hot or not part didn't come until later when they started introducing apps. Like when it first started, it was just like, it was like Friendster where you found your friends. Mm-hmm. Like when you meet someone at a party, you Facebook them and then like they couldn't even leave like messages. Like it was like you had a wall.
Then. Yeah. But like I remember like getting Facebook in my junior, in like the second half of my junior year and thinking, wow, this is kind of terrible. And it's like, I mean, it is one way to like stay close to your friends, but like, I remember thinking at the time where I was like, this is weird. Like, why are people, like, sharing everything on Facebook? So I can't imagine, like, now where, like...
It's totally changed.
Yeah.
Because when I first started Facebook, it was to get back in touch with people I've lost touch with.
Mm-hmm.
Which, was different than you because, like, when you got it, you were already
sharing stuff.
You're new, like, people in your media community, whereas I was like trying to find people I knew from elementary school, from high school, and things like that. But yeah, I'm going back to life at the temple. So, like, for the first time, she's kind of like, she comes around and like actually enjoys temple life, which is
The temple life teaches her how to appreciate each moment because, like, they thank the toilet before they go, they thank the bath before they take a bath, and it's a way for her to like slow down her life and really appreciate the present, and not get so caught up in the past, because now is like so vengeful, and I think, you know, she has the right to be vengeful at her classmates and her dad, and it's just like a way for her to just concentrate on the good things in life, which is I think a Buddhist teaching. I'm not sure, like, being present is definitely a Buddhist teaching.
It's like a Zen thing. Also improv teaching.
She finds, like, she learns about her uncle, who was a kamikaze pilot, while she's at the temple, right?
Yeah. And then she ends up idolizing him, I guess, because... So this is where, like, the teenness comes in, right? Like, the not understanding, or also the dual narratives, because, like... Because
you get Ruth's point of view on, like, the letters, too.
And she has the power of Google, and also friends that can translate letters.
Yeah, that's the thing, because, like, it's not just a diary that's included in the Hello Kitty lunchbox. Yeah. It's, like, these letters, not letters.
There's there's a diary, there's a watch, and there's, like, I think they're letters. They're, like...
Are they letters? Oh, no, they are letters,
written in French, right? And you learn that this is... So she reads... So this is where it gets, like, the
sort of meta
meta-ness comes in, because, like, there's asymmetrical information between the characters... And the other characters and you, right? So you know what Ruth knows, but Nell does not know what Ruth knows.
Mm-hmm. Like, but then there are things that Ruth doesn't know about Nell. Yeah. Like, she's like, when did she get the letters? And that becomes like a question that gets answered at the end of the novel.
I mean, kind of.
Kind of.
But yeah, so this is a really interesting part in the book where... Now gets really, really interested in her uncle's story, because her uncle is someone who decided to, like, bravely die for his country. Whereas you know through Ruth's half the story at the same time that her uncle actually didn't want to.
Yeah.
And was, like, really, like, now idolizes her uncle for putting up with bullying and remaining strong, which I guess is something that she doesn't see in her father.
Yeah.
Right. And then
who shares the same name, by the way.
Yeah.
Her dad is Haruki Yasutani, number two.
Because he's the son of Haruki number one's sister.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Ruth knows that that's not the case and still desperately wants to. It's like, it reminds me of watching, like, soap operas. Like,
oh yeah.
Or like any drama, really, where you know more than the character and you wish they would just stop being dumb about it.
It's kind of how I felt. We're bringing Terrace House back again, because I finished the part three, the batch that just came out, and there were so many parts in, so many episodes in that part where I was like, why don't they just talk to each other? Because, like, you hear a conversation between two characters, and then like you're just like, if that conversation took place with that character and the other character that they're having problems with, then everything would be resolved so much faster.
And I mean, with this book, it's like, okay, all she needs is to find these secret letters and translate them from French, and she would know the whole story.
Yeah.
And things would be better. But how does that happen? How does it happen when it's already happened?
Yeah.
And
well, also, it's like, she left temple, so it's just like, when does she get those letters? Like, when are those going to come out?
Yeah.
I heard from an interview that Ruth Ozeki did. I forgot which one, but she mentioned how there was, like, this book. I don't remember the title, but it was a book that was just filled with kamikaze pilot letters to their parents, to their wives, and... she was saying how most of those kamikaze pilots were like the brightest at their colleges. And they were very much like Haruki Yasutani, number one, who, you know, who was fluent in three different languages.
He was like one of those like melancholic, like... literature major.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Just like very emotional, very like...
Like he was majoring in philosophy and he like his whole deal was I don't want to fight in this war because, you know, that's murder. Yeah. I'm a pacifist.
Yeah.
So yeah, like a lot of that inspiration was drawn from her research in that. I'm not sure if that was there before, like in her original draft or like...
I wonder if there... were actual like secret letters too, because you have to imagine all the letters that they actually sent to their family was like,
oh yeah, it was like, censored.
Yeah.
I'm sure there were secret letters or something, some form of message that the government didn't
I mean, because, you know, Japanese people have this, like, especially during the war, they have this perception of being like just like cogs in the machine. But I mean, people are people. Like, people have their own thoughts too.
Yeah.
And especially since his mother is pretty much a radical leftist, right?
Yeah, that was interesting too. Like she was like very much like a...
This is Jiko.
Yeah, this is Jiko. Like she's like a radical. She advocated for feminism during like a period where like that was not really
during
a concept.
Imperial Japan.
Yeah.
And then like at the end, like she was ready to also like, you know, die when her son died. But then she decided, no, I'm going to become a nun.
Yeah. Because her son was just like, take care of my sisters.
Yeah.
And like the whole reason why he hadn't killed himself during training or whatever was because he wanted his family to get the pension that kamikaze pilots got. And at that, like, I'm not sure what year it was when he got drafted into the war, but I'm guessing that this was towards the end of the war where Japan was badly losing.
Mm.
And that was why they were drafting all these young men, because there were no other fighters at that point.
Yeah. Well, it reminds you of, and I think they mentioned this in the book about the one remaining soldier in like, was it the Philippines or something, that like didn't come out till like years after the war, because in his mind the war was still going on, because the only way that Japan lost the war was if there was no more Japan.
Sure. I've never heard of this before. It sounds fascinating though.
Okay.
I'm gonna Google it later.
I might have heard that from somewhere else. But yeah, I guess touching on that, a lot of the book, like the major themes and major conflict comes from like bullying and suicide. No, this is a topic that you get really, really, you get triggered about. I guess I get why suicide within Japanese culture is like a thing, right?
Yeah.
It's like a part of their...
Yeah, I actually marked the page where Haruki, her dad, now's dad, explains why suicide is so prevalent in Japanese culture. He says, "Throughout history, we Japanese have always appreciated suicide. For us, it is a beautiful thing that gives meaning and shape and honor to our lives forever. It is a method to make our feeling of alive most real. For many thousands of years, this is our tradition. Because, you see, this feeling of alive is not so easy to experience. Even although life is a thing that seems to have some kind of weight and shape, this is only an illusion. Our feeling of alive has no real edge or boundary. So we Japanese people say that our life sometimes feels unreal, just like a dream."
Yeah. So, and it's something that is a theme for both Haruki's and for now, too, maybe through influence of her uncle and her father, and also just being bullied, and bullying is a big part of it. And I don't want to touch too much about it. Just I want to say that it is a theme, and it's used as a, like, the conflict to get over. Right?
Yeah.
And I think it's
definitely like a motif in the book. Cause like you have Haruki number one, who is drafted into this war. And once he gets into training camp, he realizes how, how like the senior officers, they're bullying like the new recruits,
yeah.
And that is how they exercise power. And then you have Haruki's dad, who is ironically bullied by his daughter,
yeah.
Who is getting bullied at school.
Right, and she's bullying her dad because she doesn't think he lives up to the family name or the uncle. And also, like...
And also she bullies a kid at her school, yeah. Daisuke.
Yeah, which she also, like, later feels regret about. And, I mean, at the same time, her now's father is also plagued by guilt. And, I mean... A big part of this book is also the way that history shapes,
yeah.
You know, families, right? And you learn later that, or you learn, this is another one of those asymmetrical thing where you learn early about why Haruki number two, or Harry, is so invested in the Iraq War.
Mm-hmm.
It's because he designed the drone controls to make it fun.
Yeah.
To, like, you know.
And he was bullied. Drones. Because like he was bullied by his company.
Yeah.
Because when he invented it, he wanted it for computer games,
yeah.
And his company decided to sell it to the military.
Yeah.
And he was just like, "Why are you doing that? Like, don't do that." And then they fired him
because he wanted to like include ethical like constraints.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And like they fired him, and that was the reason why he had no money,
yeah.
Because he invested all of his savings into the company stock.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, dot-com bubble bursted,
yeah.
Like, right after he left.
And he lost everything, yeah. And so there's a lot of, like, guilt, too. It all goes into justifying why he is depressed for most of the book.
Yeah, and then with now, the reason why she bullies Daisuke is... I mean, originally it was to, like, find out, like, what her classmates were up to, but then, like, it got to a point where she could have easily let Daisuke go, and mm-hmm. She knows this. And she realizes that she feels powerful when she's doing it. And,
yeah.
Like, because she's, like, holding the knife, she's like, I'm in control. And, like, it's, like, a small amount of control. But she's like, this is the one time,
yeah.
That I am not, like, the one who is, like, down on the ground.
I mean, it goes to show how the cycle of bullying like is, yeah. Perpetuated.
And then you see this in the classroom as well, where like now's homeroom teacher is a substitute teacher.
Right.
Yeah, and he's like a complete loser because substitute teachers are considered losers according to like the classmates in now's homeroom. But like he's someone who is like not conventionally attractive. He's someone who constantly seeks approval, so
yeah.
That makes him like a prime target for bullying, and he
plays along with the classes, like he like turns a blind eye to their abuse of now.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't like that guy at all. He was,
yeah, he like,
yeah. As an authority figure he totally failed.
Yeah, I can only speak from how bullying is done in Korea, but it is like very similar in a sense that like a lot of the teachers are complicit in the abuses that happen in their classroom
because they themselves are bullied
or like I'm not sure if same in Japan, it probably is to some extent, but a lot of the times, the bullies, they're people who come from powerful families, right? A lot of the time, like, bullies in the classrooms, they're actually, like, the top students, or they come from powerful families,
mm-hmm.
And therefore, when the teacher goes to the principal and says, like, this kid is bullying all the rest of the kids, like...
Right. They get F4'd.
They're kind of like, why are you trying to, like, start waves? Like, just keep,
yeah.
Your head down. And the same thing, and, like, the whole... I forgot what now called it, but when she was completely ignored by all of her classmates, like that is something that happens really regularly in Korean bullying. We call it wangdang. Actually, wangda, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's the word. But yeah, it's like a type of bullying where you don't exist to the class, where you know, they don't say your name, or when they do, it's like in third person. They don't like direct their commentary to you. And and for now, that's pretty devastating because
she's already isolated.
And her great grandmother teaches her about being present, right? Mm-hmm. By saying like everyone is a time being. And and for now, who is suddenly like ignored by her classmates, like she's no longer a time being because they don't acknowledge her existence. So
and the bullying like escalates, and there is a very like graphic scene of bullying in the book that kind of, I don't know if it came out of nowhere, but I don't know if it was necessary to like drive, I mean, I guess it was necessary to drive her over the edge, I guess.
I think it was, it does drive her over the edge, but I would say it drives her father more over the edge because what happens is she gets sexually assaulted at school, and it's video and it's recorded and it's released to, it's released online, and there's like a bidding war for her stained underwear, and her father like under like an anonymous username tries to outbid this other person because he doesn't want his daughter to have that shame, I guess. Yeah. But then it takes it the wrong way, right?
And the fact that he bids on it, and she knows that he bids on, knows that she knows that he knows, and that's worse. I feel like, so I know that you had some issues with the way this book deals with suicide, and
I think I can divide books that talk about suicide into two different categories, and it's books that were written by people with mental illnesses, and they're writing for people with mental illnesses. And the other category are books that are written by people who aren't mentally ill and experience it either through like secondhand, or they know a friend who has gone through it, and they write the book to pretty much put the reader in the character's shoes and say, like, this is what it feels like to have mental illness or go through it. But at the same time, like, it's sometimes like really bad authors, they do it in a way where it's not accurate at all. But I feel like with Ruth Ozeki, she did capture the horrificness of it pretty well, like so accurately to a point where it was really hard for me to read this book. Yeah. And I was really, really mad that no one gave me trigger warnings because I didn't read the jacket description because I had put my blind faith in people who were like, I know you would love this book. And I'm like, why do you think that I would love this book? Because I have gone through suicidal ideation before. Mm. But I'm definitely one of those people who like prefer not to be in the reader's shoes when they're going through stuff like that, because I've already gone through it and I don't really need to relive that trauma. But another reason why I had a problem with it was because it specified like methods of suicides. Like when Haruki, her dad, is writing a letter, he's like, this is the number one way. A group of people can like come together in like a suicide club, and then this is how they would die. And then for me, that is like a huge deal, because like when people, it's scientifically proven that if someone hears about how suicide is actually done, they're more likely to do it themselves
if they're
in that state of mind. So I was like not okay with that. And I was also not okay with towards the end of the chapter when the quantum mechanics stuff happens. And there's a scene where, we'll jump back to it later, but there's a scene where Ruth finally meets Haruki, number two, now his dad. And she tells him, like, don't you think that you're being selfish? Like you shouldn't want to kill yourself. Think about your daughter. And for me, that is like the number one big no-no. Like, you do not tell anyone who is in that state of mind, because really, like, if you say, like, isn't that selfish, that makes them feel worse and more prone to going through with suicide. And also, all the things that you tell them, like, oh, don't you think, like, think about your family and your loved ones. They've thought about it. And for to them, in like a very twisted way, they think that they are better off disappearing than sticking around. And they have done all of the gymnastics in their brain. And to say that you are being selfish for wanting to kill yourself, that, like, that is something that I was totally not okay with. And to be pretty honest, like, this book was very, very brutal for me to read. Like, I've mentioned other books in this podcast where I'm like, I need to set this down because, like, it's too much. But for this book, like, it really, really was brutal because now as a teenager, and I've gone through that as a teenager, and it's like that's why, like, now's story resonated with me so much, because it's like when you're a teenager, so you're in your headspace a lot, and because there are so many things that are not in your control, you tend to blame other people. And you realize in the book that that blame can have dire consequences.
Yeah. And I mean, going back to the, like, the asymmetric transformation about, like, the meta is, like, a lot of what Ruth is, her anxieties with now story is just like, if I just can just break through to her and tell her, like, all the things that I know that she doesn't know.
Yeah.
Things will be okay. Like, she'll, like, have more perspective, I guess.
Yeah, like, more perspective and just, like, not glorify suicide, because, like, she, this entire time, she thinks that her uncle died bravely for his country and, like, filled his mission even though he didn't want to. And that was another problem I had. You don't compare other people's sufferings to your own and or to other people. You don't say, like, hey, this person is going through depression and they have, like, a successful career. Why don't you have a successful career? You have the same mental illness. Like that part, I was really not okay with. But like, I think it is accurate to how people are bullied into thinking that way, and also how a teenager who is also bullied would adopt, well, not adopt, but, like, be influenced to say horrible things to her dad like that.
I mean, I guess it comes down to also, like, the conversation about how to talk to people about suicide has evolved since this book came out.
And this book came out in 2014?
Yeah.
I think it's either 2014 or 2013, but...
Yeah, and the sad part is since then there's been a lot of high-profile suicides that have forced people to talk about...
Yeah.
And society has become, like, as, like, kind of a... As politically, like, trash fire, it's become... in politics, in terms of, like, how people talk about mental illness and differences, I think the conversation has evolved since then.
It has evolved, but it makes me wonder how much it has evolved in other countries. Because I don't think Japan really has a lot of psychiatrists, or, like, therapy isn't really...
I mean, mental illness is, like, still, like, the number one non-issue in Asian countries, right?
Yeah. And it's just, like, with... And they have such a high rate of young suicides, right? So it's just, like, it makes me question, like, have they done anything to seriously curb that? Have they, like, implemented guidance counselors and I guess, like, intervention.
Yeah, and even then, is it culturally, like...
Yeah, is it culturally acceptable? Like,
seek help. Like, not everyone can go to a Zen temple and, like...
Yeah, I mean, that was briefly mentioned when Nao says that she is pretty sure she has ADD. Mm-hmm. And, like, a lot of her classmates in Sunnyvale had ADD as well, or ADHD. And they all took, like, medication for it, except her... because like her family,
yeah,
like culturally they're not very experienced in seeking medication for ADD or any other like disorders or illnesses. Yeah. And like her best friend, like one of her classmates asks her, hey, how come you don't have any medication? And her best friend goes, now doesn't need medication. She's Japanese. And then he just like backs off. And it's just like, wow, like that.
I wonder, because I read that as a commentary on like how Americans kind of over-medicate sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, definitely. But also like it's weird because it's just like, oh, her best friend is pretty much saying like, oh, she doesn't need medication because she's tough. She has like samurai warrior spirit.
Or like Japanese robot or something.
Yeah. So I thought that was really funny. And yeah, it's like two completely opposite scenarios where it's like over medication and absolutely no medication.
Yeah. I guess that brings us to
the weird quantum physics and parallelism.
Like I mentioned earlier, I felt like I don't really understand why that was in the book. It kind of bogged things down for me at the end. Like I understand like that it's used to explain how we perceive the world.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of felt like I was reading a lecture towards the end about quantum mechanics and Schrodinger's cat.
I mean, with we are in a very strange position where Ruth is a reader when she is also the writer.
Yeah.
And I think it just speaks to how powerful the relationship between a writer and a reader can be. And it like the reader kind of wants to reach out to the characters all the time.
Yeah,
and
her as the reader actually like affects the outcome.
Yeah.
Maybe through her dream.
Yeah, well, maybe through her dream. And also, I mean, like, it doesn't happen out of the blue. It feels like it, but there are hints of quantum physics and, like time jumps happening in the book.
I mean, the book erases itself and adds, and it feels up.
Yeah.
Like, there's some
words disappear, and then also, like, when she's looking up stuff for Jiko, like, the article that she halfway read disappears as well, and she can't find it.
That was because of the electrical storm.
Yeah.
I did enjoy that part because it reminds me of like sometimes when I was doing research back in grad school, I had to like download those like academic, and it's always like here is like the synopsis, you have to buy the full report, and it's always like too much money.
I mean, didn't your school have like Nexus? I forgot the site. Wow, it's been so long since I've gone to
LexisNexis.
Yeah, LexisNexis.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how I got like most of the academic papers. I don't know.
But
maybe times had changed by the time you graduated and I went to college.
No, it was still there.
It was still there.
And then her dad, so Harry, after like coming out of his depression, decides to dedicate his life to programming security software to prevent whatever happened to his daughter to happen to anyone ever again, and creates like a way to erase yourself using quantum spiders or something.
Yeah, something like that. Like, I think the whole deal is like, if it depends on like Google searches.
Yeah.
Like if people there's like a number of searches, and then like the little quantum spider will slowly erase it so people can't find it anymore.
And then I think it was Oliver who suggested maybe that was what, like, maybe that reached out through other realities and erased stuff from other realities as well.
It's very unclear about that. And, like, with Ruth's dream, she's at the Zen temple, and she...
she's at Ueno Park first to intervene with her, Harry's plans. And then she goes to the Zen temple.
And she puts the... Haruki number one's letters
in the
cremation box.
Yeah.
And that is when she finds the letters. But you wonder if that is what happened, or that is what caused it, because the pages disappear and then reappear.
Yeah.
But then you don't know if Ruth is like going Like, Ruth has gone so obsessive that like something happened, or
I mean, it's fiction, so
it's fiction. I'm guessing that it's
she traveled into their. It's like it's like what you said, like wanting to go into the world of fiction, and like essentially, if she did what she did, then like it changes the trajectory of the story.
Yeah, she, right? And then like there are also hints of like parallel universes and time jumps with the crow. That keeps popping up, like the Japanese crow.
Yeah,
and it's like, where did that come from? And then, like with Pesto, like he disappears for a while, and like for a second, I thought he crossed over to Nao's story because like there was a cat in Nao, when Nao is at the temple. I'm like, is that Pesto? I'm not sure. But yeah, there's like hints here and there. But I do feel like when I got to the portion where Ruth is having that dream, I was like, where did this come from? I was like, I would have much preferred if it didn't go there, if it was just like alternate perspectives and then you get a conclusion. Or there's this manga that I really, really like. It's called Orange. Mm-hmm. And I forgot the author's name. I'm so sorry. But the premise is it takes place in high school and a new transfer student comes in. And the main character, this girl who attends the same school as him, she gets mysterious letters, and each letter is like marked with a date, and she finds out that that new transfer student is going to kill himself by the end of the year. Oh. So like what happens is like her future self had sent letters to her past self to tell her like what happens each day and what to do. But then halfway through the letters, like, since she has changed events, like things don't happen the way according to the letters, so she has to like improvise.
So it's like Lake House or meets Early Edition.
Yeah. But like, I really like the way time worked on that, because the theory of like having parallel timelines that is introduced as well.
Yeah,
and I was like, oh, I think that was done really, really well, and and like, I also play this game called the Zero Time Escape series, and that is like that entire game is just jumping from timeline to timeline, so you can like figure out a way to escape from, like, it's like an escape room, but you only have the information to solve the puzzle if you have jumped to other timelines and failed, and then go back into the right timeline. So like, I feel like I would have preferred it more if this book either like delved into that theory more or just taken it out completely.
It kind of feels like at its core, like you said, it's about the reader's relationship with the writer, right?
Yeah,
like a reader's relationship with the work and their personal investment in that narrative as it goes along. I wonder when the quantum, like when did it occur to the author to explain that using quantum mechanics? And yeah, to me, it did feel a little like it definitely bogged down the last like fourth of the book for me.
I know. I know Ruth has said in like past interviews that she gets inspired a lot by the articles that her husband sends her. So I'm guessing that he sent her an article about quantum physics and like parallel universes, and she's like, I'm going to put that in my book.
Anytime you deal with like timelines and multiple like parallel universe theories, like it's like a whole other discussion. Yeah. Like the way each piece of fiction deals with it is different. Like the way that she deals with it, the way that Charles Yu deals with it, the way that Virtue's Last Resort,
Virtue's Last Reward, Zero Time Escape,
deals with it. It's you know, but it's important to have like consistency.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I felt like there was consistency in the dual narratives, and then it was like, what happened? like, we had some Goodreads members really like this book. I know that there, for some people, this was their second time reading it for book club. And I know that some people have read this before and they've left reviews on the book on Goodreads. Overall, it's like, I think our book club members really enjoyed it. Do we have any?
Yeah, specifically, book club member Lauren, she reread this book for the first time since 2014, and She said that the book felt more introspective this time around, as she took in the magical realism, quantum physics, and Oliver's out-of-this-world hypotheses in stride. I guess it's one of those books where I guess the second time you read through it, you like it's like watching like a Michel Gondry like or like a Charlie Kaufman movie, where the first time you're kind of you're slapped in the face with how out of the world this is, mm-hmm. and then the second time you read it, you kind of notice what it's actually trying to say.
Yeah,
right. But she did mention that maybe it's because of her own struggles as a writer that she was able to relate to Ruth more.
Because of the writer's block, yeah. and finding inspiration, and the struggle is real.
Yeah. And Julie wrote that the blending of Zen Buddhism with quantum theory was also neat. She writes, I get that placing now in the path of something deadly and not resolving it makes her simultaneously alive and dead, but it's not the catharsis I was looking for.
You know, I do want to talk about that last scene, though. Like, that there, after Ruth talks to Now's father goes to countryside, mm-hmm. into the Buddhist temple, and they during the funeral they find the letters, and it is like this moment of like they're finding like finding common ground, you know?
It kind of feels like a, I guess, like she is the deus ex machina, right? Like that like resolves the story in a neat way.
In a neat way, but at the same time, it, you know, it does feel like it comes out of nowhere, and I guess that does come with like not a fully satisfied feeling of like now and her father resolving their issues on their own, because it was like kind of pushed together, and then there's that scene where like Jiko, because she's a Buddhist nun, she's supposed to write a poem before she dies, and she writes one character, and it's Liv.
In kanji.
And I mean, to me, I felt that was kind of, I was like, okay, like, whatever. Like, I felt very blasé about that because like...
I mean, it goes with your issues with how they dealt with, like, overcoming suicidal thoughts.
Yeah, well, right? It's just, like, the whole, like when you are on a deadline to live, you start to appreciate everything in life. And it's just like, I really don't like that narrative because I've seen it so often in movies. It's just like, think about all the things that you can live for, and everything is like much more beautiful because you know that you're going to die. And it's just like, okay, like, I don't know if that is like a Buddhist thing, because you're like the whole like Zen stuff where like you're in the present and you should like appreciate life for what it is, but
I'm actually not sure.
But like, yeah, like I didn't feel catharsis either by how things got resolved, but I did appreciate like how, like, after Now and her father finds the letters, they're like, let's figure it out together. And there's kind of like this camaraderie of like, let's live.
It was a warm moment for sure in a book where like you're kind of just frustrated at them for not talking to each other the entire time.
And then they're finally talking to each other.
Yeah.
I said earlier on in this podcast that a lot of people came up to me and said, this is essential for Asian American literature. And I just wanted to, I guess, like get your take on it. Do you think it is?
I mean, as with any book that I read for this book club, I'm glad I read it. I'm not sure if, I don't feel like, it's not a book that I would recommend to everyone. It's
won a lot of awards, and like, I think it does deserve that. I think it does a lot of interesting things that really make the story, I guess, stand out in literary fiction. And it's sold a lot of copies, and by that merit alone, I do think it is very much an important book in Asian American literature, at least like history wise. Because I don't think a book like this has gotten that many awards before, or been nominated for that many awards. But I do, the way I feel like it is like how Joy Luck Club is essential reading for Asian American literature, but I don't ever want to read Joy Luck Club because it is so depressing. Like, and it's just like, it's important. But at the same time, I don't want to read it.
I think we talked about this, how like how prestige fiction has to be depressing for it to be like essential. And that's, I mean,
we say this as like in a very, very broad general sense. Like, yeah, it's definitely not like there are books out there that are very funny and light and they win a lot of awards.
Yeah. But I guess for me, it's like a lot of the things that they covered about Japanese culture was stuff I already knew about.
Yeah.
So it wasn't as like fresh from my perspective.
Yeah, so yeah, right. Same here. I mean, there were a lot of footnotes in this book, and mm-hmm. I actually read the first half of this book through audio, and I actually wish I listened to the entire book in audio, but I couldn't finish it because I borrowed this from the library, and then my audio book rental ran out, and I was like, no.
I listened to it at 2x speed on Audible. And when you listen to it on 2x speed, the now sections actually sound like a teenage girl talking because it's a lot of like,
yeah, you know, a lot of like
when you speed something up, it makes it sound like it's like a hyperactive teen talking, yeah, you know,
as if like it's like I need you to know my thoughts, yeah, and like gushing about it.
So I think that actually added to my experience of it.
Yeah, but like in the audiobook, they like the footnotes are weaved into the book.
Okay.
So like Ruth, so there'll be like a Japanese word, and then like when you're reading the actual physical book, you have to like go down to the footnotes and like be right. Like, oh, it's like, oh, what is that? But in the audiobook, in the narration, it's just like Japanese word, and then then Ruth Ozaki, who is the narrator, she says like, oh, and that's what it is. And like, I really appreciated that because even though I knew a lot of Japanese culture and a lot of the words that they use in this book, I always got curious. I was like, oh, what are those footnotes? And it would really take me out of like reading the story. So I really appreciated reading this through audiobook.
And I mean, even the quantum physics stuff, like I watched a lot of like really heady anime growing up and played video games. So I was also kind of familiar with.
Yeah.
And as people know, I like sci-fi fantasy, so you know.
Yeah, I kind of groaned when Schrodinger's cat showed up in the book. I'm just like, oh no. it's like I have read this concept way too many times.
I think that's why it bogged me down at the end, because like Oliver literally explains the experiment.
Yeah.
During
I mean, I'm sure it's really cool for people who like are unfamiliar with it, but yeah, we're
We're huge nerds.
We're really big nerds. So it's like, okay,
yeah,
go back to the story about Nao and her father.
But yeah, on that note, I guess that'll do it for this discussion of Ruth Ozaki's A Tale for the Time Being, our July Books and Boba Book Club pick. Thank you all for listening along with us. And if you have any thoughts about our thoughts to share, please go to our Goodreads forum and sound off. We always love to hear your perspectives on the books that we read. And you can find our forums either by going to Goodreads and searching Books and Boba, or just check out the Goodreads link at booksandboba.com. But yeah, on that note, again, Reaver, what's our August book club pick?
Oh, it's a book that you've never heard of. It's called Crazy Rich Asians by Kevin Kwan.
Yeah. And it's the movie's coming out next week. The books are everywhere.
Yeah.
You literally can't not avoid this book right now. So
since it's going to be interesting because I read the book before the movie came out, mm-hmm. and after I watched the movie, and then Marvin has not read the book yet. It'll be interesting to like compare notes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm excited and also frightened.
Why frightened?
Well, because I love the movie so much.
Yeah. And I know that there's a lot of like debate about Crazy Rich Asians and like its problems of like not showing like Southeast Asian representation.
I mean,
I know the debate on Twitter. Like I've read it, and I think everyone brings something valid to the table, And we're definitely going to talk about it more in our book club discussion. So stay tuned for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, grab the book if you haven't grabbed it yet. Borrow it from your library, or I'm sure at least one of your friends has it, so you can borrow it from them as well.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Get the new imprint of it with Constance Wu and Henry Golding on the cover.
Yeah, I saw that like at the bookstore, and I was just like, I always get thrown off when they do that, they put like the movie people on the book cover, and I'm just like,
sometimes the sticker, now a movie, now a major motion picture.
I mean, like sometimes like the movie picture for the book cover is like nice, because it's like, oh, like the design is like cool, but I don't know how I felt about like seeing the new cover. I was just like, oh, like it's a book though. Why is this movie poster cover?
The motif for the original cover is actually used in the credit sequence of Grace Rich Agents.
Oh, really?
I just watched the final cut of it on Monday. And yeah, it's really interesting. Anyways,
sorry.
Definitely go watch the movie. Whether you watch the movie first or read the book first, doesn't matter, as long as you read the book. And come back and check in with us at the end of the month, where we will talk about Crazy Rich Asians.
In Books and Boba, we always prefer the book to the movie.
Do we?
But I wonder for this time around. I wonder.
All right. Rira, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thank you, Marvin, for having me.
I mean, we're co-hosts.
So. I know, we're co-hosts. We're stuck together in a basement.
And thank you for listening to this episode of Books and Boba. Really quickly, Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from our rich Asian community.
Crazy rich Asian community.
If you like what you hear, you can check out some of our other great programs, such as They Call Us Bruce, who has a really great panel discussion with Crazy Rich Asians writers and actors. Up now, you can listen to The Collabcast, which is the other pop culture podcast that I host, where we put out an episode talking about all the movies coming out in August. And if you're interested in learning more about Asian American cinema, check out Saturday School, the Asian American film history podcast by our friends Ada Sang and Brian Hu. You can learn more about these shows by going to the website podcastpotluck.com. And thanks to Visual Communications for letting us record in their office. This is where the Potluck Podcast Studio is located. Visual Communications, of course, is a nonprofit organization that supports Asian American filmmakers. They're the ones behind the Arm of the Camera Fellowship and the Los Angeles Asian Pacific Film Festival. Learn more about VC by going to their website at vconline.org. And we're looking for boba sponsors.
Yeah, if you're a boba shop, like, please sponsor us. I'm not begging or anything.
We're just asking nicely. We'll drink your boba.
Yeah, and we'll say that it's good on air.
All right.
All right. Bye.
Bye. Keep reading, guys.